Ave podcast listeners, every now and then on the Emperors of Rome podcast, we decide to do a deep dive into an important text, analyse it chapter by chapter, and make it its own mini-series. The limited run, available to supporters only, and you can get access through crowdfunding. What you're about to hear is the first episode of a mini-series on the Germania, a look at the ancient text by Tacitus. It will run anywhere from between 6 to 8 episodes, depending on the support, and it will get both interesting and quite nerdy, even by our standards. If you'd like to listen to the entire thing, you can find the Germania campaign on Kickstarter, and there will be a link on our Facebook page and the show notes for this episode. Thanks. I hope you enjoy. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast with Matt Smith and Rhiannon Evans. This is episode CCLVI, Germania. Tacitus's Germania is one of the most fascinating, strange, and surprisingly modern texts to survive from the ancient world. Part ethnographic survey, part moral provocation, part geopolitical warning. It describes the tribes living along Rome's northern frontier, their customs, their gods, their warriors, their women, and their stubborn refusal to become Roman. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
We're talking today about a text that has been used in a really egregious and outright racist way. And there's a lot going on in the world that it might sort of set off anxious or traumatic feelings for you. 2 massive wars going on in the world at the moment. Some of what we're discussing touches on anti-Semitism. So, you know, I do want to tread carefully here. I don't want to overstate this. Most of what we're going to be talking about is an ancient text, but towards the end, if we follow our order, which is not always the case, then we will be thinking about the way that the Nazis used this text.
Yeah, because they did. Yeah, anything that can be weaponized will be weaponized. The text that we're talking about is the Germania with a hard G. And it's author Tacitus who most famously wrote histories and annals.
I think the annals is the most famous. The annals is the one that deals with the early emperors and especially Nero.
And Germania is one of his lesser, minor kind of works, but not any less important.
I feel so proud that you say with a hard G that I've learned that over the last 10 years where there's no J sound in Latin.
No, that's right. Something, you know, kind of worked its way into my mind.
So Tacitus wrote the histories and the annals. We have very little of the histories, alas, not all of the annals. But we have what have been called his 3 minor works. So the Germania, which as we'll be talking about, is an ethnography of Germanic peoples. I'm not going to call them the Germans.
No.
We have the Agricola, which is in large part an ethnography and history of the governor and Roman general Agricola's time in Britain. So there's a lot about the Britons there. In a similar way to the way the Germans have used the Germania, the British have often looked at the Agricola.
It's
a story
text
for another day.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Even though it's the Romans who are colonizing them. And a third one, which I think is the most obscure, which is called the Dialogus or the Dialogue, which is about Roman rhetoric and how it's all falling apart because we've lost the Republic. So Tacitus starts writing, the Germania comes from 98 CE, not too long after the death of the hated Emperor Domitian. And he's still hankering for the Republic, which was dead 130 years
ago. Long time dead. Yeah. For the good old days.
He had no memory of it in his lifetime. And I'm generalizing a lot here, but it does come up a little bit in this text. He has this kind of rhetoric, this narrative of how Rome is in decline and it's all gone downhill since we had one emperor in charge and the Roman elites didn't have autonomy anymore. They couldn't get to power, that the consuls have no power. And, you know, he gets to be very high up in that system, but it's sort of honorific rather than real political power anymore. So the Dialogus is interesting because it talks about that decline, but it's there in all of his works.
Mm. So this is primarily a work of ethnography. How common was that for the time? Were there other works of ethnography? Or what was he trying to achieve by writing in this way?
It's a tough one.
Yeah.
We don't have any other work that is purely ethnography. So ethnography is there in lots of works from the start, from very early on. If you go back to Greek literature, and some will have read Herodotus, All right, he spends the first five books of his 9-book history talking about the peoples conquered by the Persians, which a lot of that, I mean, the whole of book two is a kind of ethnography of Egypt. So it's there in histories. One of the things that has worried scholars about the Germania is this is just ethnography. This is just about Germanic peoples. It's not seemingly fitting into a history. Now, classicists and ancient historians don't really do this anymore, but I was reading a piece yesterday that was trying to explain what the Germania is for, and it really struggled because history is the only thing worth writing, according to old-fashioned classicists, all right? If it's not part of history, why would you be writing it? And you want war-to-war history, so this should be about events. So there used to be a theory strongly held that this is like the notes that he'd made, that he was going to write a history about the German peoples. So yeah, this is the background and it would fit it in somewhere. And I guess playing a part in that is that Julius Caesar had written an ethnography of the Gallic and Germanic already, although not very many chapters on the Germanic peoples, a lot on the Gauls, in book 6 of his Gallic Wars.
Now, so it was just part of a broader work then.
Yeah, but even that, there used to be scholars who wanted to excise it or put it at the beginning, like an introduction. Oh, like, why is it suddenly in book 6?
I do have a copy of that. I think Penguin published one, and it isn't even too long ago.
Early 1980s, translated by Anne Wiseman and an introduction by T.P. Wiseman, who is still alive and is a huge deal in classics. Peter Wiseman is a really famous classicist who used to be at Exeter. But they made that decision to move the text around because they were uncomfortable with ethnography being in the middle of a history of a war.
Okay, back on topic though. So this one, Tacitus does have precedence. I mean, there's a bit of ethnography, as you said already, in the Agricola, but this is just purely this work. So why do you think? He'd never been there, as far as we can tell.
No, we don't know that. And it's unlikely he went there, given what he has to say about it.
Yeah.
We don't know. We can't know. We can't say definitively. But he tells us in chapter 37 that the Romans have been fighting Germanic peoples for 210 years and they're like the people we can't defeat. So he's kind of obsessed with them. Another thing that I think he's doing, and I don't even know if this is conscious, but there's a great article by a woman called Hester Sade, which is called No Place Like Rome, which is a title I really wish that I...
That's a good one.
To, yeah.
Could have made a good podcast out of that title.
The full title of it is Concerning the Origin and the Geographical Location of the Germanic Peoples. So like any text called that, this is, of course, a text about Rome, which is a joke right at the beginning of her article. And really a lot in here is about this is what we are not. This is what we could be. This is what maybe we used to be. And this is something acknowledged by anthropologists now, that often when you write about other peoples, you can't help writing about yourself. Even if you've embedded yourself with them, as Tacitus certainly hadn't, then you've got your assumptions that you're bringing to looking at these people. There might be aspects that you look at because of the society you come from rather than what's important to them. It's pretty explicit at points in Tacitus, as we'll see.
We've said already that it's unlikely that he went there. So how accurate do we think his work is? Because we don't have a lot of information as it is about the Germani region. But we do have this text, we do have some stuff that Caesar has said, so accuracy.
I would put it pretty low myself.
What could he be working with then as sources?
So he's definitely read Caesar. He echoes Caesar a lot. He might have used lost books of Sallust, who wrote a history that we have just the odd line of, and maybe of Livy, who wrote a history that we have loads of, but not the later bits that would have been useful for looking at the Germanic peoples. I know it's a mouthful saying Germanic peoples, but I don't want to call them the Germans. It's not like using Gauls, because it doesn't sound the same as French, does it?
Well, we'll get to that, structurally, it's a different territory,
broader territory. There's something called, this is not an ethnography, but it's called a chorography by a man called Pomponius Mela, who I wrote about in my PhD. But he's so obscure that the article I wrote from it is still used a lot because nobody else has written about him.
You're the primary source.
There are 3 books in this choreography. I think it's fascinating. And he does some crazy stuff where he talks about hybrid peoples being spontaneously generated from the soil of Egypt. So you can see how reliable Mela is. It might have been used by Tacitus because his stuff on the Germanic peoples is not as crazy as that.
Mm.
And there was a map. We don't know how accurate this was or what form it took, but Agrippa, who was a kind of right-hand man of the Emperor Augustus, had made a map of some sort that was put up publicly in Rome, a world map. All right, so that might have been consulted too. Also, there was Pliny the Elder, who you might have heard of, who died in 79 when Vesuvius exploded. He wrote a history of the Germans. We don't have any of it. It was probably long, given the work we have by Pliny, is his encyclopedia, his natural history, which is 37 books long.
Mm, and full of lots of interesting ideas. All right, so let's talk about Germania itself and kind of get a lay of the land of the lay of the land.
Okay, so you're talking about Germania the place, not
yes,
the text.
Yes, yes, clear. Yes. So what is this book covering?
So it does two things. It doesn't look as Germany as a space, really, but it looks at the German peoples. So as we've said, ethnography. But what is it covering? Well, the Romans sort of established that the Germanic peoples started at the Rhine. All right, so you've got Gaul, one side of it, on the western side. And once you cross the Rhine, they're Germanics. It seems to start with Julius Caesar. He makes that very strong distinction. And then to the south, so you go north from Italy and you get to the Roman province of Pannonia, which is sort of Switzerland, Austria. And then you hit the Danube, and that's kind of the southern border of the Germanic peoples. And then it goes east and north, and it all becomes a bit vague because we don't know what goes on out there. And where is it not Germanic peoples anymore? Tacitus isn't sure, as we'll see when we get to it. So kind of north into Denmark, even Sweden, and then into Eastern Europe, Estonia, all the way to Russia. So it's kind of vast. And he talks about them being one people in the first half of the work and then divides them up into lots of different peoples in the second half.
Yeah, he almost goes tribe by tribe, giving little characteristics and hints and facts and everything. But it spans all the way from coast to coast almost. You know, he talks about the water regions and the far north and everything. And it's just, it gets vaguely somewhere off in this area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and I should add, it starts with a tiny bit of the Netherlands. Any Dutch listeners will be appalled, I think, if we don't include that. Because the Rhine...
You know they will contact me if you do. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yep. So right at the end, it's 46 chapters long. As you know, chapters are short, so that's not like a novel. The penguin version of the Germania is with the Agricola, and it's still one of the slimmest penguins you'll ever see. And that's with notes as well. It's tiny. You could read it in an hour or maybe two. So in chapter 46, the last one, last chapter, he says, I'm unsure whether I should put the Puccini, or it's very Italian pronunciation, the Puccini, the Veneti, and the Feni with the Germani or the Sarmatians, who are a sort of, oh, they're really wild tribes out in the northeast that the Greeks had talked about. And beyond them are the Fabulosa, are the sort of made up peoples, or maybe made up peoples, people we don't know about, people they tell about. They are hybrids with human faces and animal bodies. And Tacitus says, well, I don't know, that's unproven. He doesn't say they don't exist. He says, I don't have evidence. And then he just stops.
Okay. Like,
that's unproven. And then the text just ends with this kind of, I'm out of my depth here idea. So much certainty before that. And then it's way out northeast. Who knows what happens there?
And you said that Rome has a long history of interacting with the Germani peoples. So is this an important work to inform? Because these are people that the Romans wouldn't understand, would they?
Well, you could read it as a justification for why the Romans haven't conquered the Germanic peoples.
And it's not for lack of trying, really.
Yeah. I guess at the start, they are defending themselves, they'd see it as, from peoples coming south into Italy. So you might have heard of the general Marius, who's around the turn of the second, first centuries BCE, fighting against Germanic peoples who are called the Cimbri and the Teutoni. And they come south and he gets made consul 5 years in a row, which is illegal according to the Republican Constitution, because they need him there to fight off the Germani. And eventually he's victorious. I mean, one way of reading the Germanic peoples in ancient history is that they're a set of people who are on the move a lot, sometimes because they've been pushed out by other peoples, often because of that. And that's one of the reasons they're coming down into Italy at that point. But because the Romans have an empire by that point and consider themselves masters of the Mediterranean, they're not going to tolerate this. So it's not the very first interaction, but it's a really important early interaction. Hmm. And then after that, well, you have Caesar crossing the Rhine in the 50s. and he has various little tussles with the Germanic peoples, but then he seems to set the Rhine as the boundary. I'm not really going to deal with them. I'm just going to warn them off. Then we come to the transition from republic to empire, and Augustus sort of fixes the borders and doesn't do very much, but he sends various of his heirs, and especially under the next emperor, go out there to the Germanic regions, very little success. Even under Augustus, the interaction they do have with the Germanic peoples is disastrous, yeah. Which might sort of seal the fate of later ones. So a general called Varus goes into German territory, and at what is called the Battle of the Teutoburg Forest, he loses 3 legions, which is hugely disastrous.
Yes, Quintus Varus, where are my legions?
Yes. So yes. Matt knows about this because it's a famous line from I, Claudius.
I know about it because we interviewed Brian Blessed, and he yelled it at us a number of times.
So this was a terrible shame for the Romans. So they kind of have disaster after disaster, and then it sort of continues under the emperors in bits and pieces. And Domitian claimed that he had had a triumph over the Germanic peoples. And as we'll see, Tacitus laughs at that and says, it's not a real triumph, nothing happened. He did actually, and this has some contemporary resonance too, he built a wall, some people call it a fence, which probably did deter some of the Germanic peoples from coming further into the west and the south. So there was kind of at least a what the Romans call a limes, a boundary, which the Romans didn't always have. There wasn't an official boundary, and that sort of laid one out. So, you know, well, it's hard to know how to feel about this, but Domitian gets pilloried for not doing anything. He probably did do a bit more in Roman terms than they gave him credit for, but he was an emperor who was murdered, so they tended to say lots of negative things about him afterwards. And Tacitus hates him.
You're a Domitian apologist, though, in this aspect?
No, I'm not.
Okay, all right.
I'm not an apologist for building wars.
Okay. So let's talk about the work itself. We've already said that Tacitus goes through it and divides it. He'll talk about a tribe, give a few characteristics, and move on. So would the Germani think about themselves as one people or as a series of tribes? How united were they? Did they have a concept of Germani?
No? I don't think so. Yeah. There's no evidence for that. I should say that the evidence for them being a culture distinct from the Gauls is also not great. So the archaeological evidence seems to suggest that there is a similar culture on both sides of the Rhine. So it's probably a false distinction anyway, that these are one people over the Rhine. But no, I mean, they're fighting battles against each other all the time. This is a Roman imposition. Later history would suggest, in fact, tells us that they have common language because, you know, English is a language derived from Germanic languages, but that doesn't go all the way, you know, in Eastern Europe, Slavic languages come in. So that's not entirely true. But even the name German, Germanic, Germani, is one that Tacitus can't really explain. He says, oh, you know, it seems to be the name of one little tribe and then it gets generalized to all of them.
Sure.
But there's no way they call themselves that. Even today, Germans don't call themselves that. They're Deutsch.
Yeah.
And we don't have good evidence for it outside of archaeology. We don't have texts from them.
Yeah, no written works from there.
But based on other ways that the Romans talk about people, they're very happy to impose their own labels.
So how is Tacitus deciding to cover this then? How is he dividing it up in his work?
In the first half, first 27 chapters, he talks about them as one people and describes them and tells you about their customs. And then the second half, he tells you about individual tribes, which is contradictory because then they all seem in opposition to each other. They have different customs and some of them are more warlike and some of them are more civilized. And so he kind of generalizes and then he particularizes.
Okay. So let's cover some of the content then. What does Tacitus tell us about the Germani people?
So when he's talking about them as a whole, he says they all look the same. They're fiery, they're tall, they're red-haired. He says they are kind of egalitarian in ways that we might approve of. So there's no kind of dynastic kingship. They do have slaves, so not entirely egalitarian. He probably didn't approve of that, by the way. So there's kind of merit-based. If you're a good warrior, you might rise through the ranks. He sort of talks about them as they don't have that much agriculture, or at least they're not that good at it. They don't really like doing it. They're warlike all the time, and their rite of passage for boys is that they become a warrior. He clearly thinks that some of their simplicity is to be lauded. So their funerals are very simple. He likes the simplicity. All right, there's no extravagant show of grief. Only the women mourn, which is the way it should be. Men should be stoic, the more or less stoic use of that. And then when he moves on to individual peoples, we get more of this, because one of the peoples he particularly loves, chapter 30, he talks about the Chatti, and they are tough, strong-limbed, they're vigorous, they look threatening, but they're also rational and clever. But then he says they are the greatest threat to Rome, because they're not just going to run into battle. They'll think about it. They'll have some strategy.
Yeah.
This is one of the reasons people thought, oh, this is a kind of manual for how to handle the Germans.
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, Romans see the Germani at their worst. Every exchange seems to be battle and fighting and everything. So you're going to see the aggression, the warlike, or at least that's going to stand out more than anything else. And that's mostly what this text is concentrating on and highlighting, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess because the Romans have never definitively defeated the Germani in battle, this works, but it doesn't cast them as ultimately undefeatable, except maybe the Chatti.
Well, they're the greatest threat.
Yes. There are things that he doesn't approve of in the individual peoples. There's a lot he doesn't approve of. And he talks a lot about gender politics. I've really only talked about men, but women are definitely important here in both good and bad ways. We're way east because this is chapter 45. He says, bordering on the Suiones, who we think are in southern Sweden, are the nations of the Sitones. They resemble them, i.e. the Suiones, in all respects, but one, woman is the ruling sex. So they have queens or female chiefs. This is the measure of their decline. I will not say below freedom, but even below decent slavery.
I mean, I'm laughing, but that's terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not unexpected, is it?
No, not really.
So he doesn't like it when women aren't kept in control. And he does like it, and this is back in his general section, when he's talking about the Germani as a whole, clearly wouldn't apply to Suiones, I guess, is that he has this big kind of propagandist chapter around chapter 18 where he says that women are bound by marriage. They are chaste. There's no adultery there, he says. There is no adultery. And then he makes a pointed comment and says, they just know how to do that. They don't need laws. Laws are not needed there to ban adultery. This is because Augustus had brought in and then Domitian had kind of backed up again Roman laws which criminalized adultery, especially for women.
Oh, right. And he's saying they don't need those laws.
Just inbuilt.
Yes. Trust me. I went there. I tried. They don't need laws.
Oh, God. He also says they don't abort children. So this is part and parcel of, for Germanic women, marriage and motherhood is their role and they know their place, quite frankly.
Right. So does he admire them?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, it's very hard to see that.
Except for that one tribe ruled by women and under decline.
Yeah, as I say, it's paradoxical and contradictory. Yeah.
But this, yay from Tacitus?
Yeah. He talks about them in very high terms for this reason.
Is this one of the reasons that he's writing this text then, to go, look, there's something we can learn from their way of life? Or
he doesn't directly say we can learn. I mean, I get the impression this is more this is what we used to be.
Yeah.
It's not explicit, but then, you know, he's writing for Romans. I guess he doesn't need to be. It would be, they would know what that means. When he says they don't need laws, that is pointing the finger. Pointing a moralizing finger at your audience and saying, this is what you should be like. Maybe this is what you used to be like, both the past and the future. He doesn't approve of the way they are now, is the important thing.
All right. So this work is vaguely contemporary with Agricola.
Oh, the same year they published.
Okay. All right. So in that, he uses it as a chance to kind of critique how Rome is doing in Britain and to kind of obliquely, subtly, not so subtly, criticize Domitian.
Yeah.
Is he doing the same sort of thing in this work, critiquing how the Romans are going against the Germani and also just how much of a toe rag Domitian is?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, he says that, as I say, it's taken 210 years. We haven't defeated them. And he's got a good comment. Another one of Tacitus loves these pointed comments. He says, we have triumphed over them more than we've had victories over them. And this is pointing to Domitian's claim to a triumph over the Germanic peoples. Indeed, he gave himself the name Germanicus. And he might be pointing also back to Caligula, who put slaves in his triumph instead of...
Sorry, if anyone's a toe rag, Caligula would be the most appropriate one to be a toe rag.
Right. Well, I'm glad you've got a kind of a chart of Roman emperor toe rags.
No, little boots. Little boots.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah, it was a pun. Yeah, Caligula means little boots. Military boots.
I just Latin punned you and you didn't get it.
No. It was a bit too broad, I think.
All right.
So He is having a go at what he loves to have a go at, which is we can put on a show, but what's there to back it up? What's the substance, right? Everything is surface level now. And you're not just talking about emperors or Germanic peoples, much broader than that. But here where he's talking about Romans against Germani, he uses that as a weapon to attack emperors who they haven't put the hard yards in, but they've taken the praise,
yeah,
is the idea. So it's not real. It might make you feel good on the day of the triumph if you're an imperialist, but there's no reality here.
So it's a hollow victory.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, he doesn't want Domitian to have the ability to say that he was a military hero. But if you think that Tacitus is being brave here, Domitian had been murdered in 96 CE and Tacitus published this in 98 CE. And Tacitus had had a very good political career under Domitian. Mm. So you could certainly read this as a lot of texts that suddenly appear as anti-Domitianic in the aftermath as, oh, now we can say what we like, there's freedom, but also a kind of survivor guilt. I managed to make it through that regime. I have to show, but I was anti him all along.
Mm.
I wasn't just playing along.
Now
I was, only playing along because you had to, and you can be a good Roman even under a dictator. There's a lot of that going on too.
So can we now turn the conversation to the significance of this text? So the Germani left no text of how to describe their own histories or people in detail, really. And this is the best that we've got. And it's written by an outsider. So how significant does that make it?
If you want to find out the truth about the people east of the Rhine in first centuries BCE and CE, I don't think it tells you very much at all. It tells you a lot about Roman attitudes, or one particular elite Roman's attitude towards other peoples, and that they've got, and we see this in Caesar as well, a kind of hierarchy of barbarians, as they'd have called them, and the Germani are more dangerous than the Gauls, that kind of thing. And it's more interesting than just we're better than them, as we've seen. In some ways, we're worse than them. Mm. Right? So he's using this to attack Rome itself. But he does talk about them in a way that becomes really significant for various reasons that Tacitus could not have foreseen. And this is right at the beginning of the text where he's talking about the Germani as a whole. He calls them a pure race. So in chapters 2 and 4, if you want to go and look at them, in chapter 2, he says he believes the Germani are, he calls them indigenas, all right? They're indigenous. There's very little immigration there. And he goes on to say, it's very hard to get there. People used to get places by sea, and the sea's really rough. So he means largely the North Sea and I guess the Baltic. It's too dangerous to get there. He also says it's kind of gloomy. It's not great land. People haven't immigrated.
1-star review.
That bit tended to get ignored, as we'll talk about.
Yeah.
And in chapter 4, this is the most kind of infamous passage, so I'm going to read it out. Personally, I agree with those that hold that in the peoples of Germany, Germania, there has been given to the world a race unmixed by intermarriage with other races, a people distinct and pure, like no one but themselves. So their physique, as far as you can say for such vast numbers, is identical.
Hmm.
They are one race. They all look the same. And that sameness, as I mentioned, is tall, red-haired, fierce-looking in the eye, blue-eyed.
The red-haired bit gets dropped in later years, I think.
Yeah, he does use a word that generally means red, but ancient color seems to have been perceived a bit differently to us. So because Italians largely darker-haired, not entirely, but sort of reddish and blonde sometimes get conflated.
Yeah.
But yeah, he uses a color that largely means red. And yeah, as you say, that's not the image that later...
No, this is an idea that has been taken, that has originated in this text and been in later years used for completely unintended reasons by Tacitus.
Yeah, because Tacitus doesn't say that that's a good thing. He says, I think this because, I don't know, how many Germans has he seen or Germani? 2 or 3 probably, but the ones who've been described to him, the description's the same. And he thinks it's not a great place to go. It makes no sense for the Romans anyway, because I'm not promoting Romans here, but it's a different way of seeing belonging to a people in that their foundation story, without going into it in depth, is one of people coming from elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so the Trojans came from the Far East and founded the Roman people. Romulus invites all kinds of just criminals and weirdos in at the beginning, to be honest, immigration. then they have to go get their women from somewhere else in a pretty sordid way.
And it's conquering all the tribes of Italy.
Yeah. And, you know, they do have a system of giving citizenship to ex-slaves if they're freed.
Mm.
So it is a hodgepodge. It's a very homogenous picture. And Tacitus isn't saying that's wrong. It's not using this to say the Germani are better than us because they all grow from one place.
Mm.
He's saying that's what I think they are. It's very neutral and factual.
But how does that idea get used then?
No, well, I'm sure you can imagine. I mean, for a long time, this text is ignored.
For a long time, it's lost.
Yeah. One text of it is found in the 15th century, a single manuscript found in Hersfeld Abbey in 1425 and taken to Rome, along with some other Tacitus texts. And it starts to inspire the sort of idea that the Germans, I guess they are by then, have these warlike qualities in various crusades against the Turks throughout that period. There's a really good book on all of this by a scholar called Christopher Krebs. His book is called A Most Dangerous Book, which is a quote itself. He talks about its whole history, but in the last two or three chapters, how it becomes an important part of Germanic identity, particularly in the 19th century, when Germany was uniting, eventually unites in the later part of the 19th century, and that it's important to that sense of Germanic self, and therefore of Nazi ideology when we come into the 1920s and 30s.
Mm.
For example, the Nazis' convention in Nuremberg in 1936 had a Germanic room with quotes from Tacitus' text all around the walls. All right, so he has a huge effect on Germanic education during that time. So it gets employed in the textbooks of the schools. And it's used to bolster, in particular, that Nazi ideology on women and their place as mothers and that they should be chaste. Their whole kind of purpose was to breed more children and to stay within marriage. And that you can make a direct appeal to chapter 18 of the Germania when you do that.
But how do you ignore the more problematic passages that don't cast the Germani people in a good light?
Don't put those quotes on the wall at Nuremberg,
well,
for one thing.
Just selective editing.
You certainly don't concentrate on where Tacitus says there's not a lot of farming there. It's mostly done by the women and old people because the Germani, the men, are lazy. They only want to go to war. They're not interested in agriculture.
Mm.
And you mistranslate things. So just leaving out little phrases, or Tacitus uses the word connubium, which means marriage. It's the normal Latin word for marriage. Literally means marriage outside of your family, all right? So not incest, I guess, marriage with other groups. Legal marriage. The Romans are obsessed with legality. So, you know, you're meant to marry other Romans for it to be legal marriage, but there are kind of exceptions to that where connubium can be granted. Connubium can't be granted to slaves, but then it can be granted to ex-slaves, and it can be granted to Roman citizens. And that gets translated as a German equivalent of crossbreeding. All right.
Okay.
This idea
they
that
gave it those
they don't have crossbreeding because they only have marriage within their own type.
Mm.
It's used as a tool in this really dangerous way, in ways that Tacitus could not have anticipated. It's quite surprising in some ways because Hitler wasn't a huge fan of this idea. He was a bit worried about the bits that get left out for that very reason. This idea that we are these uncivilized, primitive barbarians, this is where we've come from. But other Nazis loved it, and he kind of gets swept along with it. So it's great that Germanic men have strong bodies. Let's just sweep the primitivism under the mat. And simplicity, okay, primitive, not so much.
That was Rhiannon Evans, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. This episode on the Germania is the first part of a podcast mini-series available to supporters only. It is currently funding on Kickstarter, and there will be a link in the show notes for this episode. Emperors of Rome is an independent podcast now on Patreon. If you like what you hear, please consider giving your support at patreon.com/Rome Podcast. A special shout out to our first triumvir, William Twersky, a historian and classicist from New York City. Thanks for your support, William. Ave to you. This podcast has been recorded and produced in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.